Something coming faster than any of us can imagine and will change our lives in the most dramatic ways is AI.
And while AI used to sound freaky to me and just something that was going to take over my world, it really would have revolutionized my practice had I stuck around. Many of you know, I got so burnt out from charting. It was the big reason I left medicine because I was frustrated with the EMRs, the clunkiness, and the amount of time it took to learn them. Not only that, but not being able to sit and connect with a patient and look them in the eye, like one-on-one while you're actually interacting with them, the whole reason we went into medicine, not to do paperwork.
Yeah, so that's why May and I have started working with Lindy.ai, which is fascinating. They help you produce the most efficient notes, fully customizable, which is different than some other AI products, so you can do what you do best, which is see patients and let the artificial intelligence scribe do the dirty work for you.
Yeah, not only do you get the perfect patient notes the way you want, written in any format, for whatever specialty you're in, and maybe you're in ophthalmology or vet medicine, it will also create the note, scribe and send the patient follow-up instructions, referral letters, consultation notes. It's amazing. Lindy is offering our listeners a 7-day trial to experience the difference of their AI medical scribe. Go sign up at lindy.ai/bsfree to get started. That is Lindy, lindy.ai/bsfree. Hey everybody, in appreciation of all the love and support you've given us over the years, we're launching a special contest we'd like to call Share Your Thoughts and Win Coffee. Or instead of cocktails with cocktails, I don't know, it's coffee and comments. And we're looking to make this a bit of a celebration, a way to give back to this wonderful community that's been with us through thick and thin. So what's up for grabs? Not one, but 2, 3, maybe more lucky prizes for 2 separate winners. The prize package includes a freshly roasted 12-ounce bag of amazing coffee from Farewell Coffee Roasters, a BS-free MD Yeti to keep your beverages just the right temperature, and a surprise book personally selected from Tim and I. We're really excited to see who will win this fantastic bundle. And to enter, all you need to do is help us out by leaving us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform. That includes Spotify, Rumble, or YouTube. Share your thoughts about our podcast, what you've learned from us, or your favorite moments. For a bonus 5 entries, share this contest on your story and tag us. This will be available in video for you to do on social. And remember, the more friends you tag in separate comments, the more entries you'll get. There's no limits. We're accepting entries until midnight on March 13th, so don't miss out. And we'll announce the winner on our podcast and reach out directly to them, so keep listening. It could be you savoring that delicious Farewell coffee soon. Good luck, and thank you from the bottom of our hearts for being such an amazing part of our journey. And stay tuned, stay healthy, and who knows, the next cup of coffee could be on us.
Finally, a source of raw, real, and honest information on healthcare issues that matter most. Welcome to BS Free MD. From the latest medical information to how to stay sane as a doctor or a patient, no subject is taboo, no BS is allowed. Now, let's welcome your hosts, Drs. May and Tim Hindmarsh.
Welcome back to another episode of BS Free MD, where we are honored to have with us again as a guest, Dr. Kelly Victory on our show. And today we're talking about her battle with breast cancer and advocacy for personalized care in this revised doctor is patient episode. Kelly Victory is a distinguished trauma and emergency specialist, emergency medicine specialist with an extensive background in disaster preparedness and public health. And, you know, while the world was gripped with the C-19 pandemic, so to speak, she was faced with a personal health battle herself going through breast cancer. And really, this experience brought some unique insights into the dealing with the healthcare system, patient advocacy, and the pharmaceutical industry's innovations. And today, we have Dr. Victory on with us to share her journey through cancer treatment during, you know, this unparalleled crisis, but also to emphasize the importance of advocating for personalized care. And also we talk and discuss the importance of using alternative methods for cancer treatment other than the standard blanket surgery, radiation, chemo, but other supportive medications, treatments, and what's out there. So join us as we talk about these really important aspects of medicine that we seem to have forgotten about, as well as advocating for patients being the best decision makers in their healthcare. We think you'll love this episode.
Okay, we're back, Doctors May and Tim Hindmarsh with BS Free MD, and we have the awesome honor of having Dr. Kelly Victory back with a very personal story about her interaction with the healthcare system. And we are going to go down some amazing roads. So let's not wait. Let's get into it. Dr. Victory, welcome back to BS4MD. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me back. It's always great to be with you guys.
We had an amazing discussion last time and people loved it. This episode, I'm excited to kind of reopen the, because we haven't done a doctor as patient episode in a while, but you've got your own medical story and journey that you've walked down and experienced things on the other side of the aisle or of the bed, which, you know, I have a whole lifetime of experience in that myself. But so we love to hear, and our audience loves to hear from physicians and healthcare workers, you know, experiencing the medical system and how they navigate it, as well as their own emotional journey and how that changes. I'm just going to let you take it away and start off with, you know, what happened in your life that, and what medical walk did you go down that kind of opened your eyes to things?
Sure. Well, thanks for asking. I've had my fair share of medical issues. I've been a patient more than I care to admit. Lots of them orthopedic because I've been very active. But you know, in the midst of the COVID debacle, and that's what it was, and I spent so much time talking about it that I almost forget my own, you know, experience. Had nothing to do with COVID at all. I have a very, very strong family history of breast cancer. My grandmother died of breast cancer. I don't have an aunt or a female cousin who's got both breasts, unfortunately, many, many cases of breast cancer. So I've always been really, really pedantic about my routine screenings. And not just for breast cancer, by the way, colon cancer, skin cancer, all those things. So despite what was happening during the pandemic, many, many people missed their routine screenings for those things. And we should come back to that, the number of people who missed those routine colonoscopies and mammograms and those sorts of things was just tragic because we're now finding lots of cancers late. But I was very good about it. I went for my routine screening. So just this past July, I went in to get my routine mammogram, and for the first time ever, I get one every single year, despite the recommendations being every 2 or 3 years. I get one every year, and they said, oh, we see something different. We see something we hadn't seen before. It's probably nothing. Let's wait 6 months and repeat the mammogram in February. And I said, well, that's a really dumb idea. This is a screening exam. And if we see something that's new and unusual, how about we stick a needle in it and get a biopsy? And honestly, the radiologist was very nice, but pushed back a little. He said, well, it's probably nothing. I said, yes, but it might be something. And I would prefer to go ahead and get it biopsied. And I really pushed for it because I knew that.
Did he know your history at the radiologist? Usually they do have that background info. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I went so far as to ask him to redictate the report because the original mammogram report was read as low suspicion lesion, recommend repeat mammogram in 6 months. And I said, you know, if you would redictate it, that says low suspicion lesion, recommend either repeat in 6 months or biopsy, then my insurance will pay for the biopsy. And that's the way the system works. So he said, sure. And I sat with him and he redictated it. And he just said, same thing, low suspicion. But in my viewpoint, a screening exam is supposed to be the, you know, the proverbial canary in the coal mine. It's supposed to be the early warning sign. If you then ignore the early warning, and I waited 6 months, you know, it would have been a very different outcome. So I did push for it, and I actually pushed and got the biopsy the next day because I was very aggressive. I said, I want this done. This was still July. I got the results 2 days later and found out that I had a very aggressive invasive ductal cell carcinoma, and was, kind of the wheels fell off the bus. I don't care if you're a doctor, I don't care how many years you've been doing it. When you read that report and you hear those words, it's terrifying. I had actually gone into my own medical record and gotten the report before I'd received the call from the radiologist even telling me. So I already knew, said, okay, wow, all right. And I went into, you know, action mode and called a friend of mine who's a surgeon up in Los Angeles and said, how quickly can you get me on the surgical schedule? So this was a Saturday. I just found out, you know, I had breast cancer, and I got scheduled for surgery 4 days later. And I just said, I need this out of me. Now, still remember, you know, the average person would have been waiting 6 months to get a repeat mammogram. So I went to Los Angeles, had a subtotal mastectomy. Fortunately for me, I ended up having negative lymph nodes, meaning it had not spread to my lymph nodes yet. So although the tumor itself is deemed to be very aggressive, then that's when they look at it under the microscope and they do the, you know, the markers on it. They say this is a very aggressive tumor that happens to be estrogen positive, meaning that it feeds off of estrogen. But the good news is it had not gone to my lymph nodes. I came back to my home base to recover from surgery, and they wanted me to wait 7 to 8 weeks and then start radiation, which is the standard treatment for that, where even though it hasn't spread your lymph nodes, they sort of carpet bomb, if you will, the rest of your chest wall with radiation. It makes sense to me, and the data on that is really very good. So I said, sure, but why am I waiting 7 to 8 weeks? And they said, well, you know, just to make sure you fully healed. I said, hooey, you can heal in 4 weeks. So thank you very much. Let's start radiation in 4 weeks. And that is what I did. So I subsequently did 20 rounds of radiation. So every day, 4 or 5 weeks, I did radiation and got through it like a champ. They don't even think about starting any. But at this point, again, I'm being aggressive, aggressive, aggressive. So then you go to see, I had an oncologist. I never wanted to have an oncologist, but, here we are. I now have an oncologist. So I went to see the oncologist, who then started me down the path of, here's the protocol. Here's what the standard treatment is. You've done the radiation, and now the treatment is for you to be on 5 to 8 years of a chemotherapy pill, an estrogen blocker specifically, something that will make sure that you have zero estrogen in your body, because that's what this tumor feeds on. Now, these drugs, they're called aromatase inhibitors. They have a lot of really, really, really bad side effects. I'll be honest, they do. And so to me, I went back to my baseline of everything in medicine comes down to a risk-benefit calculation. What is the risk of doing nothing? What is the risk of taking this medication? What are the potential benefits? Now, this is an area that I didn't know the data on, the literature on, so I'm relying on my oncologist. And I asked a question, and the reason I bring this up is because I see this happen every day in medicine. When you ask, what is the benefit of this? And they did this a lot with the COVID vaccines. They do not distinguish between absolute risk and relative risk, or absolute benefit and relative benefit. And here's what that means. The example I would give is, if I told you that if you wear a rubber suit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the rest of your life, you will decrease your risk of getting hit by lightning by 99.99%. Okay, sounds great. You've pretty much eliminated your chance of getting hit by lightning. But what was your risk of getting hit by lightning in the first place? Okay, almost zero. So you have decreased, but you know, to almost zero, something that was almost zero already. So unless you understand the difference between absolute risk and relative risk, you can't make a decision. So here I am. Granted, I'm a physician, but I don't know the data on this. And I have an oncologist who says, Kelly, if you take these highly toxic aromatase inhibitors, this estrogen blocker, you will have a 30% improvement in survivability. Well, shoot, that sounds 30%. I mean, that's a big number. Yeah, you know, everyone wants to, I don't want to die. I don't want to die from this. I'm still terrified. I mean, I've just come through, you know, a mastectomy and 20 rounds of radiation. My, you know, mind is reeling. I'm still trying to work full time. All of this during, and somebody tells me, well, if you take this, you have a 30% improved chance of surviving. Well, that sounds pretty good. Until I got into the weeds. And when I asked the oncologist and she couldn't answer the question, I said, is that relative improvement or absolute improvement? And she couldn't tell me. So here's, I said, well, thank you. I'll take that under advisement. And I went into the research myself. And what I found out was that somebody with my type of a very aggressive cancer, the size that it was, which was 7 millimeters, less than a centimeter in size, without spread to the lymph nodes, if I do nothing at all other than what I've done, surgery and radiation, my chance of sitting here talking to you 10 years from now is about 92%, 93%. Okay. In other words, there's a 7 or 8% chance that I won't be sitting here if I do nothing else at all. If I take the aromatase inhibitors, that 30% improvement, it's 30% of the 7% chance that I wouldn't be. In other words, I'd gain another probably 2.1%. In other words, rather than a 93% chance of sitting here, there's a 95%. Okay, so now you're talking about, for a 2% improvement, am I willing to take a drug that causes overwhelming bone loss, overwhelming joint pain, arthritis, debilitating hot flashes, significant weight gain, brain fog, depression, the sorts of side effects. So now, but it wasn't presented to me like that. It wasn't presented that if you take this drug for 5 to 8 years, you'll improve your chance of being here 10 years from now by 2%, because that's the reality. Okay. So then you start asking, why would people do that? Why would a doctor do that rather than be very honest about it? Well, there are a couple of options, or, you know, number one, she doesn't know, because doctors actually are, because the pharmaceutical company has proposed this to the oncologist, or the pharmaceutical company has proposed this to the internist or the pediatrician, that this is a great drug, and they haven't, and the doctor hasn't taken the time themselves to do the research and figure out, or because the doctor wants to be able to sleep at night and say, I did everything I possibly could, and if Kelly Victory dies of breast cancer, it's not on me, you know, Dr. Oncologist, I did everything I could. I encouraged her to do every last thing. And it could be that. Or is it because there's money to be made in the system, and the doctors, all, you know, 80% of doctors are employed either by a large medical group or by a large hospital system, and the hospital is highly incentivized to do these things. So I don't know the answer to it, but I can tell you, if you're not aware and you're in this time of fear, and believe me, I was terrified. I was terrified. I was saying, oh my God, I don't want to die. I got a lot of stuff to do. You know, I got a lot of people to tick off. I got a lot of, you know, important things to say. You know, I'm a pit bull. I got stuff to do. If you don't know to ask the question, what is, you know, when somebody tells you, a doctor tells you that it has blank percent, you know, chance of helping you, you need to find out if that's relative or absolute for starters. So let me take a break there. That's the story.
Yeah, there's two things that come to mind, like just blow out of my gigantic fleshy head.
I have a lot of things, you go ahead.
Which is there, you know, Mark Twain, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Mm-hmm. I think it should be there's lies, damn lies, and relative risk. The whole statin debacle mm-hmm. and putting everybody on statins was based entirely on relative risk.
Yes.
We're talking like, and even then, when you do meta-analysis of primary prevention, the relative risk itself is virtually zero. It's just non-existent. The other thing is we have to treat patients as patients and not as pegs in a system of everyone gets the same treatment.
Right.
So we have all of these tools like the CHAD score and all this for who needs to be on anticoagulants. Well, I work in South Florida. I see tons and – I mean, I swear to God, you could go to Baskin Robbins here and get Eliquis sprinkles on your ice cream. And I sit – and you see a 95-year-old patient come in mm-hmm. with a walker.
Right.
And they might have had atrial – they might have atrial fib. And they're on a blood thinner. And I'm like, why? Why?
Right.
Because the cardiologist – Their conscience is clear if they die of a cerebral hemorrhage and don't die of a stroke. Like, it doesn't make sense. We have to treat no one fits into any of these scoring things.
Yeah.
They're just tools. They're not absolute indicators.
We've lost the point of the patient should be the one who gets the informed makes the informed decision based on, you're right, the risks, the benefits of these medications.
Mm-hmm.
It's their life. It's their quality of life. And you can provide them the info. But I think you're right. A lot of physicians don't know the difference between absolute and relative risk, and that's why they're not providing it. I know that in our career doing family practice, when we would send people to oncology and they were started down these weird bunny trails and treatment plans and patients who had they clearly weren't going to make it, and they were mm-hmm. pulling out all the stops and chemo, and their life was miserable the last 6 months that they had. And we would sit down with the family and mm-hmm. say, you know, do you really want to do this? And they're like, we're never presented with any other option. It is almost like Tim said, that it's like ticking the box, or they have to win. It's like they mm-hmm. want to say that mm-hmm. they did everything without letting the patients have all the information and trying to present it in a way that they can mm-hmm. understand and letting them decide. It's their body, their life, and making that choice for themselves. And I think we've mm-hmm. lost that.
Well, totally lost it. Like my other personal favorite was heart failure. Okay. Congestive heart failure is a terrible diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Most can't you out-survive. If you have most cancers out-survive people with a new diagnosis of heart failure.
Right.
And patients don't understand this. Okay, so then you send them off to the cardiologist and they do a bunch of different things and they, you know, optimize their diuretics or whatever. And then, you know, the new thing back in the late 90s was Coreg. So everyone gets mm-hmm. a blocker. Well, most of these people, they come back, they cannot function at all.
Right. Right. Their lives are ruined.
Their lives are completely ruined
right.
for literally like, what is it, a 5 or 10% difference in longevity for a terminal illness, because that's what it is. Well, no one has had the discussion with them that says, look, this is a terminal illness. How do you want to live for the next, you got maybe 5 years. How are we going to map this out? And overwhelmingly, that conversation ends with, get rid of the damn pills.
Yeah.
So I was like a Coreg wrecking crew for so many of these patients, because I'm like, they were just miserable. They were in agony. They could not function. It's just like, you treat patients, you don't treat studies.
So I start, you know, I'm don't want to make my, you know, oncologist mad at me. But I am a physician. I'm perfectly capable of making my own decisions. So I started doing other research and finding out that there are other things that aren't what I call, they fall under the bailiwick of, quote, alternative treatments. But the only reason they're alternative is because they don't make some large pharmaceutical, you know, company a lot of money. It's not that there aren't studies behind them, because there are huge studies on a lot of things that are deemed alternative. So here, one of the things, for example, that we've known for decades is that having your vitamin D levels at a adequate level significantly decreases your risk of ever developing cancer or of having recurrence of cancer. And the level, interestingly, of vitamin D that is recommended that we all trained around was to have a level between 40 and 60 nanograms per milliliter, okay? 40 and 60. That is not what the studies show, however. All of the studies show that you need to have your level at least 80, and that 80 to 90 is really where you want it. So, lo and behold, my vitamin D levels, even though I was supplementing it to get to a level of 60, I needed to raise up my vitamin D, which I did. Studies on mushrooms, medicinal mushrooms, reishi mushrooms, turkey tail mushrooms, lion's mane mushrooms, huge studies going back for decades. These are supplements that are taken very, very commonly in Eastern Europe. They're very common in Asia, readily available, absolutely inexpensive, zero bad side effects, nothing negative about, and the studies are remarkable. I already knew about the turkey tail mushrooms because I had a Labrador retriever that had breast cancer that we treated very successfully for some years with turkey tail mushrooms. So I started taking those. Modified fruit pectin. So I started taking a host of different supplements readily available. Then I started looking at the overwhelming data on ivermectin. Ivermectin, you know, the horse paste that we weren't supposed to use for COVID, that we've known for, you know, again, for decades, is a very, very powerful antiviral, has very, very strong anti-inflammatory properties. Well, it turns out they've also known, again, for decades, that it has a profound impact on cancer, specifically lung cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer. And the literature is replete with studies on it, studies you are hard-pressed to find because the pharmaceutical companies don't want you to know about it. Now, I decided not to start taking ivermectin yet because as I sit in front of you today, I am theoretically cancer-free. My tumor is in a bucket in a landfill somewhere in Los Angeles. I was fortunate enough to have negative lymph nodes. I carpet bombed my chest wall with radiation to make sure that if there was one cell left behind or one that got potentially spread during the biopsy process or the surgical process, we've wiped it out. So I'm holding the ivermectin as what dry powder, if you want, that God forbid something comes back, I've got it. In the meantime, I did get convinced by my oncologist, who I like very much personally. She's a lovely person, even though I think she's missing some components clinically. I got convinced. She convinced me to try this aromatase inhibitor. And she said, just try it once a week. You're supposed to take it 7 days a week, but just try it once a week. Take it once a week for a month, and then maybe the next month you take it twice a week. And then she's desperate for me to take this drug. So I guess I found it hard pressed to, you know, to argue with that sort of, you know, dipping your toe in the water. So I tried it and I took it once a week for 4 weeks. And then I went and had routine blood work done, and my white blood count had gone in the gutter, absolutely cratered. And I called in a panic and said to my oncologist, holy, but Jesus, my white blood count is stunningly low. And she said, oh, that's a side effect of the drug. And it's a side effect that she had not ever mentioned of the ones that I rattled off, you know, joint pain, hot flashes, all this. Nobody mentioned to me that in about 10% of people, your white blood count can get profoundly impacted. And that's when I said, you know what? Here's the reality. My best chance of fighting off this cancer and keeping it from coming back is my immune system.
Yep. Right.
The last thing I need to do is destroy my immune system, because not only am I then at risk for my cancer coming back, I'm at risk for a heck of a lot of other things, including all of the other cancers that are out there and all of the infectious diseases that are out there. And why in the world would I do that? So I went back after a month and I said, thank you. I tried it. Thank you very much. I'm done.
So here's the big question. And I know people would be thinking it, and us too. So what's the reasoning behind this? What's the incentive? So I know that some oncologists, I mean, do get kickbacks from, they order drugs, they prescribe mm-hmm. them, they get kickbacks on those. Not all.
Chemo, they do.
Chemo, for sure.
So yeah. Is that the biggest incentive for pushing that? Or is it just that they really are desperate to tick the boxes? Is it just finance? Is there the financial incentive?
Yeah, but most aromatase inhibitors are pennies.
No, that's what I mean. So that's the thinking is, are doctors really getting paybacks from this?
Why? With chemotherapy agents, there's no question, IV chemotherapy, there's no question that they make money on it. And many of them own infusion centers where people go to get these drugs and everything else. With these pills that I was prescribed, it's not a financial issue. I have come to the conclusion that this is because they are following a protocol that has studies behind it. And as long as they do this, they think, number one, they are free from any malpractice, having committed any level of malpractice, and because it helps them to sleep well at night. They say, this is the protocol. I'm following the protocol. I'm just doing, I'm doing what I was told to do. I'm just following orders. I'm just following what my, American College of Oncology, tells me I should do in order to be a good doctor. And I think that this is where we've really gone awry, that we have lost our ability to actually, the doctor-patient relationship, that sacrosanct relationship has gone by the wayside. It happened way before COVID, but it became glaringly obvious during COVID that we have gone off the rails, that it's no longer a one-on-one interaction between a patient and a doctor saying, what's best for me? What's best for you as an individual? Everybody really focuses now on, that the answer to this, and for the past decade or two decades, the idea of concierge medicine, the idea that you're going to have this one-on-one concierge doctor. And if you really look at it, what the average concierge doctor offers you is better appointment times, longer appointment times, extended hours, better parking. That's not my idea of concierge medicine. My idea of concierge, I say, how much do I have to pay for a doctor who's capable of non-algorithmic thinking? How much do I have to, pay for a doctor who's capable of truly customizing my care? Sitting down and asking something like, Kelly, what are your goals for this? What are your fears? What's important to you? Anybody who knows me personally knows that, a huge part of my life is being physically active. A huge part. Being debilitated with arthritis, and not being able to move and having, muscle and joint pain is it takes away the one of the great joys in my life, which is being physically active. But if nobody asks that question, and so I would submit to you that when people think about concierge medicine or personalized medicine, care less about the extended hours and the extended appointment time, and really, ask, are you getting into a relationship with somebody who's saying, I don't care what the protocol says. We'll start with that as a basic guideline suggestion list, but we are going to tailor whatever we do to you, to your individual. One of the things, again, talking about lack of critical thinking and algorithmic thinking is, I was hospitalized earlier in the pandemic. I had an accident and ruptured my Achilles tendon, a horrible injury, by the way. So I'm hospitalized right at the beginning of the pandemic. I have two medical allergies. One is to tetanus toxoid. I had a horrific, I developed Stevens-Johnson syndrome after a tetanus shot and was hospitalized for about 6 weeks when I was in college. So I don't take tetanus shots, and I am very worried, concerned about vaccines in general, but it's certainly not Texas. And the other allergy I have is to polyethylene glycol, PEG. Which is one of the key ingredients of the COVID shots was polyethylene glycol.
And colonoscopies.
Right, exactly. So If anyone's ever been hospitalized, you know that if you have an allergy, they get emblazoned on the front of the chart in big red letters, and you know, so everybody can see it, and you wear a wristband that says your allergies on it. When I was hospitalized for my Achilles, I lost count after 20 people over that time came in and asked me if I had had my COVID vaccines. And I said to each person, have you ever looked at the front of my chart? You know I have a polyethylene glycol allergy, right? Key component of the... And to a person, they'd say, I know, but you're going to be here in the hospital. So if you have a problem, we can... I'm thinking, you've lost your mind. You've lost your mind. If I had penicillin as an allergy on the front of my chart, do you think anyone would have come in and suggest that I take penicillin and that it would be okay since I'm in the hospital and they're there to take care of me if I have an untoward reaction? I mean, of course not.
No.
This was the groupthink, the absolute inability to say, this is somebody who's not getting a COVID vaccine. You know, obviously I wasn't getting one for a lot of other reasons,
right.
But the fact that I had these allergies made it, you know, there's no way, no how. So it's interesting what happened. But yeah, to a person, nurse after nurse, are you sure? I'm saying, yeah, I'm still sure today. I was sure yesterday. I'm still sure today.
I'd be like, how good are you with that epinephrine shot? That's all I want to know, lady.
Yeah. but even the idea
would
suggest this was because, again, if you had any other allergy on your chart, but it was became the, you know, it's all, you know, COVID vaccine uber alles, you know, everybody has to get vaccinated. That's all we really care about. And I see this. So I think the answer to the question about with cancer treatment is doctors have a really hard time breaking and saying, this isn't what's best for this patient. The protocol may be, and when I've asked my oncologist about some of the supplements, for example, like about the mushrooms or ivermectin or these sorts of things, vitamin D, her answer is always, well, those things haven't been studied. We don't know. And we've studied the aromatase inhibitors. So we don't know. We're saying, no, we do know. Yes. It's simply that big pharma doesn't want you to know. And so there's a big disconnect.
That's a cop-out answer because a lot of them have. But I was going to say, but there's two thoughts I have. One is back to the advocate thing.
Yes.
You know, it's sad to say, but the family physician kind of used to be supposed to be the quarterback for the patient's care and the advocate to go through all that. And yes, we would send people out to the oncologist for the expertise and guidance, but bring it back home and say, okay, you know, how is this drug making you feel? Talk about alternative options if they were going to their natural path or getting acupuncture as well, supplemental things. That's not happening anymore.
Right.
And I'm not quite sure why. And the other thing is now we have this specialty called integrative medicine, which I think they're trying to put a name on it to say that I'm a doctor that cares about other therapies other than just prescription drugs. And I don't know if that's, you know, working out well, if people need to seek out an integrative medicine specialist because they're going to look at more of a holistic approach, or what your thoughts are on that.
Well, there's something,
but I know
that
a friend of mine who's undergoing treatment for stage 4 colon cancer. I think we talked with this, you about this before or on the episode, but she is literally keeping secret from her oncologist some of the alternative therapies she's using because she's asked about them and it was like a no way, you know, the mushrooms. The Joe Tippin protocol, and you didn't talk about that with using mebendazole or fabendazole for treatments where there is data and not a lot of, I would say it's more anecdotal evidence, but there's studies in animals, but she's afraid to even now share that. She keeps it a secret because this fear of, well, maybe they'll change my treatment plan or maybe they'll withhold the other treatment, this shunning. And so that I think is horrible as well, but that's what, you know, people are having to go through. And I think it's not refreshing, but for them to hear that us medical professionals struggle with this as well, not just people on the outside. And how do we, I don't know, back to what are your thoughts on this whole integrative medicine and someone looking out for the patient on all aspects of their health? I mean, is it really going to be a success?
Well, first of all, I think it is absolutely critical to have that. We've known for a long time, let's face it, that it's not just about the medication that you take. It's about your nutrition, your activity level, your spiritual wellness, your emotional wellness, and having a team approach where somebody's looking at all of those things. Absolutely, hands down, there's no question. I absolutely understand your friend with colon cancer's feeling about you don't want to disappoint or make angry the person who's you believe is the person in charge of taking care of you. You know, your oncologist, you don't want to disappoint that person or think that you're going, you know, that you're doubting them or that, you know, you don't really trust their judgment. So you lie, you know, you don't say it. Believe me, if I start taking ivermectin, I have no intention of telling my oncologist.
Right.
And back to, by the way, fenbendazole and metbendazole, again, two other, they're anti-parasitic drugs have shown great promise in the treatment of cancers. And there's some great books on this. There's a physician who's actually in Northern California who writes under the pen name Justice Hope. And if anybody's interested in reading a book, there's a great book on surviving COVID disease and cancer with repurposed medications. And you talk about not only the vitamin D and the mushrooms and the ivermectin and fenbendazole, but other things are in it. Metformin is another drug being used. There are so many things that we know. And the studies, again, some of them are studies on humans, some are on animals, some are on both. But really, really compelling data out there. So if you want to look into a little bit more about the repurposed drugs, I'd strongly suggest that particular book. It's easy to read. Back to the whole issue of guidelines and advocating for yourself and screening. I might mention the guidelines have changed quite a bit over the years. And interestingly, they haven't changed on the basis of any scientific studies. When Obamacare was passed back in 2010, prior to that, the recommendation for mammograms was for women over the age of 40 to have a mammogram every year, over age 40. All of a sudden, it changed to every other year starting at age 50, and then nothing after the age of 70. Now, was that based on some scientific study that showed that we didn't? No, it was based on an actuarial study, a financial study. The drug company, the insurance companies know darn well that we will miss some women with breast cancer with that new algorithm, with that new protocol of every other year starting at age 50. But they consider it an acceptable loss. They will save X amount of money. So many times the guidelines change, not based on what is best for you as a patient, but what's best for the insurance company or the hospital. And you need to be aware of that. So when I was advocating for myself, I said, here's the deal. Why would I all of a sudden change the frequency with which I'm getting mammograms just because the insurance company has changed their guidelines? So for a long time, every other year when it wasn't covered, I had to fork up the, whatever it was, $200 and whatever to pay for the mammogram myself because it wasn't covered by my insurance. And I think that people need to really think about that. What is, if you are at high risk for something, do your own advocating, do your own research, find out how frequently really should I be getting this study done, or are there things that I can do in the interim, in the off years, to make sure that I'm taking care of myself? The other thing I think that is just pathetic is that during the entire COVID debacle, none of the talking heads in public health were educating people about all of the other things you should be doing to stay well. It's like hide in your basement, stay away from others, don't go to church, don't socialize with your family, binge watch Netflix and eat Pringles. That was the and then get vaccinated, make sure you get vaccinated every 15 minutes. instead of saying, look, we know the importance of physical activity. We know the importance of adequate sleep, regular exercise, good nutrition, social interaction, all of those things. We knew that getting your vitamin D levels up would be very, very helpful. Those sorts of things. And instead, you know, people got fatter, more sedentary, more despondent, more reliant on drugs and alcohol. And it went the exact opposite way of where we would have wanted it to go from a public health perspective.
Right.
And
talking about the Pringles and diet, I mean, that's another big factor mm-hmm. in health overall, for sure, that it just makes my head explode because America's getting fatter and we have yeah. more happy people dancing on TV with their Jardiance and Ozempic that are obese than not. And we're doing poorly at that as a nation. And that always seems to be the big failing point. But it's also a controversial thing, even in cancer treatment, you know, back to what I've seen with people, like my friend, even I'm not sure about you, but she would talk about doing different things with her diet, such as low carb, keto, and mm-hmm. same thing, push back from the oncologist. No, we want your energy up. Don't do that. So
right.
doing things on the side.
But that part is just completely insane. We had to interview a dietitian who doesn't counsel patients as a registered dietitian for what she did with cancer, because she would probably lose her license in Canada because mm-hmm. she's very pro keto. And she's like, mm-hmm. look, cancer cells have to have glucose. They can't survive right. on ketones. So correct. How come it took me 30 years of medical practice and a freaking podcast before anyone told me that? Like that yeah. should be the baseline information. Your cancer patients need to be on a low carb diet and they need to learn how to intermittently fast because yeah. you can starve cancer. You can literally starve it. You may not cure it, but you're going to age your other therapies.
100%. And I have lived by intermittent fasting for years just because it's been proven to have a positive impact on, you know, glucose intolerance and insulin resistance and those sorts of things.
And it's built into your job in the ER.
Exactly. So intermittent fasting, just to be clear to people, is where you go for a, you know, a period of time where you don't eat. So generally, you know, you say you eat only in an 8-hour window. You know, for me, I eat between noon and 8 p.m. and I don't eat for the other 16 hours. One of the reasons that we believe that Western cultures like ours have such a high cancer rate compared to other places is because your average American eats constantly. I mean, they might go 8 hours without eating. You know, you're constantly eating. And there's some huge health benefits to going for periods of time where you don't. Since I got diagnosed with cancer, I began what they call sort of long-term fasting, where and the data on this are overwhelming. I fast for 5 days out of every 30. So I do a 5-day fast with almost nothing other than water every 30 days. It is not fun. It's not, but it's very doable. And when you're motivated, you can do anything. The reason that, as you said, that longer term fasting like this for a matter of days, when you get to 72 hours or more, where you do not take in any glucose or any substantial food, you know, more than maybe 50 calories a day, is that your body goes into, essentially you are stressing all the cells in your body. Your cells are fundamentally saying, holy crap, apparently no food's coming our way. We are in starvation mode. And it starts to eat its own. It goes into autophagia. And the cells that get eaten up first, the cells that it goes after, are the weak ones, the debilitated ones, the old ones, the ones that aren't quite right, i.e. cancer. And your body starts to catabolize, starts to eat up those bad cells. It not only has a profound impact on cancer, and not only curing cancer, but keeping cancer from recurring, but it has a huge impact just on your overall wellness. People drop, you know, it certainly helps you to drop visceral fat, but it also helps with insulin, again, insulin management. There's studies on long-term fasting like this show that if you do 3 cycles in a row, meaning 3 months in a row, you do one of these 5 days, you can take your chronologic age, your metrics back 2.5 years. You can gain to, you know, go back. It's really quite, the guy who really designed this won a Nobel Prize for this program. His name is Walter Longo. He's a PhD mm-hmm. out of Southern California. You should look him up. Prolonged fasting. Walter, it's W-A-L-T-E-R, Longo, L-O-N-G-O. He's a PhD, U.S., I think he's maybe UCLA, Southern California. Yes, but he is very, he's written prolifically on this and has put together a program that the average person can follow. So whether you have cancer or any other health concern, I would strongly suggest it. And you don't have to do it once a month like I do. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who now, because of what I've started doing, they now do it maybe every 3 months. But I'm a huge proponent of it. And I agree with you, Tim, that why is it we never were taught that cancer cells feed on sugar? That's what they eat. They feed on glucose. And that therefore, you know, you certainly want to be cognizant of that if you've been diagnosed with cancer, and don't be feeding it in the same way. You know, all my oncologist is concerned about is that I don't feed it estrogen. Well, yes, it feeds on estrogen, but it also feeds on glucose. Right. And it's a lot easier and more tolerable for me to fast 5 days a month than to take this toxic drug for the next 8 years and destroy my entire life.
So short of, you know, being very intelligent and knowing where to research things yourself, I mean, what can we provide like patients and listeners with as a guide to being, you know, that having to be your own advocate in times like this? Where should we turn other than just listen to podcasts and, you know, hitting Amazon for books on fasting or alternative treatments? Any suggestions on how to be your own advocate and where to look for this kind of information?
Well, I do think there are huge, huge groups out there, made that, you know, for every kind of cancer. The huge, you know, people have mm-hmm. learned on their own. They've put together, there are enormous communities out there, not only to support you emotionally through it, but for me, more to say, like, what are you doing? What dose of, you know, ivermectin are you taking? What dose did you try of this mushroom? Where did you source your mushrooms? You know, what did you, and there are people out there, people have come out of the woodwork. Once I started looking, most of them not physicians. Most of them were people who said it wasn't readily available in the medical literature, so we went and found it on our own. I've, you know, two people that I would seek out in terms of what they've written are Justice Hope and Walter Longo. They, again, and this is not, when I say alternative, I don't mean, this isn't, you know, like snake oil. This isn't, you know, I read that putting a piece of bacon on your forehead, you know, will cure breast cancer. You know, it's, I mean, this is stuff that has hardcore studies behind it, right? And not just in the past 6 months, studies that go back decades where they've known about it. And here's another, you know, another example. You say, think about COVID. Why is it that doctors tried hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19? Was that just sort of on a whim? You know, why hydroxychloroquine, the drug that President Trump took and, you know, got derided for, and the drug that I got kicked off Twitter for initially, you know, when I said hydroxychloroquine has been FDA approved for use in humans since 1942, which it has. Why did doctors try it? Oh, well, maybe it's because there actually was a huge study done in 2005. By right. whom? By Anthony Fauci. Exactly. Anthony Fauci, who said, turns out hydroxychloroquine was profoundly effective against SARS-CoV-1, the COVID outbreak that happened in 2003. They knew darn well that hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine were very effective against this type of a coronavirus. So it wasn't a leap to say, well, gosh, if it worked really well against SARS-CoV-1, maybe it'll work against SARS-CoV-2. And lo and behold, it did. But these are things that the pharmaceutical complex and the powers that be would like you to not know. But it doesn't mean that it's not known. The data are out there and there are huge communities. So I would recommend, number one, if God forbid you find yourself in the position that I am, that you find yourself a good integrative physician. There are groups that do it. Certainly, it's one of the things, for example, that Cancer Centers of America was very good at. They brought together all the specialties, including the holistic and emotional, psychological components, big focus on nutrition, which your average physician doesn't do. My oncologist to this day has never talked to me about increasing, for example, my intake of cruciferous vegetables, which are well known to be cancer preventive. So find an integrative physician and then reach out to the support communities that will look at what are the other things. And that's what I asked people. I said, what are you doing other than what they told your oncologist told you to do? And people are like, oh, let me tell you, I'm doing this and this. And they're happy to talk about it.
Awesome.
No, this is great. There's something that is so instructive about your story, because with COVID, there's now this massive distrust of, you know, three-letter agencies and physicians and all of this. And the danger is we abandon really good allopathic medicine and assume that all of it is bullshit. And then we go straight into these other alternatives, which also have a lot of BS. You know, we had some really good interviews with a couple of chiropractors. I love how they think. We need to learn from them. But at the same time, we also agreed that we each have a lane. You know, I don't need a back adjustment if I fall off a motorcycle. Yeah. I probably need a trauma surgeon.
Oh, big time you do.
So it's the concept of doing everything, everything that works and nothing that doesn't work for my individual case.
Right.
And the other big problem here, and you said it a couple times, is algorithmic thinking. Algorithmic thinking will kill medicine because it's not focusing on the individual patient. And algorithmic thinking is what the industry wants more than anything.
Exactly.
Because they know the only hindrance they have to absolute carpet bombing the world with pharmaceutical agents is physician licenses. If you think that you're going to be a good doctor just using an algorithm, the AIs will kill you because they'll be able to do it 100 million times faster than you and better than you. So you better start focusing on individual patients and bringing, you know, spirituality and psychology and a holistic approach, because otherwise you won't have a job.
And here's the thought that I would leave you with. You're 100% right, but this was purposeful. Not only do they want you to be wedded to algorithmic thinking, that's what the electronic medical record was all about, okay? It has nothing to do with improved, you know, efficiency. It's fundamentally a billing module that forces you into certain protocols and algorithms and doesn't allow you to order something or go down a road that the algorithm doesn't want you to go down. But there's a reason. This started again way before COVID. This started when medical schools stopped teaching the four the pillars of medical ethics, the four of them. Your average physician under the age of 60 can't even tell you what they are. Autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. And the reason they stopped teaching those is because they all focus on the individual, not the collective. They focus on individual autonomy, the fact that you have a right as a patient to make decisions for what is right for you and only you. There's no such thing as taking one for the team in the pillars of medical ethics, okay? You don't get vaccinated to help the person next door. That's what autonomy is about. Beneficence is the concept that a doctor should never prescribe something that isn't known to help a patient. Not just not hurt you, but help you. You shouldn't be doing it. Non-maleficence is, you know, sort of the first do no harm idea, that the last thing you want to do is do anything that would harm them. And justice has to do with really what is just and right for that person, not society. It's not equity based. And they stopped teaching those four pillars of medical ethics some decades ago. And as all it's, you know, really went, it was coincident with this move to the collective. And now you're actually vilified as a physician if you focus on the individual rather than what's best for society. To wit, my experience laying in a hospital bed with a ruptured Achilles, and all they kept saying is, you need to get vaccinated. Well, why? I know I don't need to get vaccinated. You want me to get vaccinated so that you can check the box and say that 100% of your patients are, and that you don't have people in that. Okay. Has nothing to do with Kelly Victory, the individual, and only to do with the collective. And that is it, absolutely, they have abandoned the medical ethics on which they should have been trained.
Well, that's,
wow. I feel like we should take up the offering now. That was awesome.
So I have to get this in because it's a key part of the doctor's patient. And yeah, I'm going to, you know, make you be a little vulnerable here if that's okay. But,
sure.
You know, a big part of getting through these things that we do is, you know, even healthcare workers as patients is the emotion of being on the other side. And that's the biggest part of getting through any health problem is having your mind and your emotions and your spiritual strength in the right place. So what was it like? You know, you're an ER physician, you're used to detaching emotion and just, you know, treating patients when they're having traumas and things are going on and there's family crises. When it's you in there, you know, and you shared a little bit about, yeah, you're scared, but did you just kind of like, okay, I'm just thinking, here's what I got to do to get through this. I'll feel the emotions later. Were you feeling them as they went? Can you share a little bit about that, like what you felt going through that?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, I clearly prefer to be on the handle end of the scalpel, not the pointy end. I don't do so well on the pointy end. And I am, you know, some would say a control freak. I certainly don't like giving over my control of things to anybody, even colleagues that I trust. When I went into the operating room, they had the IV in and I said, if I were you, I'd put me out really soon because otherwise I'm going to start telling you how to do your job. In about 5 minutes, I'm going to tell you how to do this case. So they were like, quick, put her to sleep.
Shut her up.
Exactly. Truly, all joking aside, I was terrified. And I thought, you know, this can't be happening to me. I went through all the stages of holy, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm so cautious. I do all of my screenings and you realize you're very, very, very vulnerable to something that this had nothing. There's nothing else I could have done. Of all the risk factors, my biggest risk factor, I suppose, is genetics and stress. But I was scared. I happened to be somebody of great faith, so I relied heavily on my faith. I reached out immediately to all of the prayer warriors in my world and said, hey, turns out, I need a favor. Now I'm on the other side. You know, I need you to start lifting me up spiritually and in prayer. I was very honest with people about being scared. I actually asked the surgical team. I said, before you give me the first said, you know, my pre-op sedation, I said, I would like you to pray with me. And we did. We prayed in the pre-op. We did. I asked the surgeon to come in. I said, you know, a good friend of mine for 40 years. And I said, I need, you know, part of this is medical and part of this is spiritual. And I need to know that we've lifted up this and put it in God's hands before I go in there. It was a very emotional time. And after that, you know, I was at the gym the day after my surgery. I went to the fitness center and people said, you know, now you got me all. people said, I was at the gym the day after surgery and people said, what the heck are you doing here? And I said, well, you know, they cut off my boob, not my leg. And so I said, I'm here to work out. And I did. Granted, I was walking very slowly on the treadmill, but I needed to maintain that, that structure. For me, I needed to maintain my routine, said, okay, we're going to get through this. And I had some moments where, you know, you get overwhelmed with that anxiety. For me, it's generally at night when I'm, you know, laying in bed and I think, oh my God, is it coming back or is it going to spread or am I going to be you know, the 7%? Am I going to be, you know, what can I do to not be the 7% that aren't sitting here 10 years from now? You know, and how do I manage that? And so I had moments. It's very much a, when people talk about it as a journey, I think that's the right word, because it's not linear. It's not, you know, for me, it undulates. I'd have great days and then have days where I felt very, very despondent. Like I don't want to do this again. And I said, you know, I've been through a lot of stuff, as I said, I've had more surgeries than most people I know. And, I said, you know, the old adage is that God never sends you more than you can handle. And, you know, apparently God thinks I'm a badass because he keeps sending me stuff. And I said,
you and me both.
I keep sending me things. So, I would really encourage you. And that's where I think I'm not suggesting that everybody has to have faith as their crutch. But for me, it was a huge support to have that. And I would recommend or really suggest that you find whatever that support is. What if it's just friends, if it's a friend. I walked and walked and walked with friends, with a couple of friends who just were willing to listen and listen to what you listen to, how I was feeling physically, listen to my concern about taking these meds and am I doing the right thing? And I'm not going to take the pill and I'm going to try the pill. And then the pill made me feel awful. And, you know, but for me, it was walking and talking. And I think the worst thing you can do is stay isolated and give into it. You know, for me, I'm not one to give in. I was at the fitness center every day because that helped me stay centered and say, no, I'm not taking delivery on this. I am not going down with this. You're going to have to send something way bigger than a little breast cancer to take me out.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. I had to eke that out of you because, you know, people think there's, I don't know, some subset, whether it's physicians or people, that it's just like, oh, they don't aren't going to struggle with this because their brain's different. The mind is such a big part and I believe our faith in how the body responds. And I think it's important for people to know that even you, Kelly Victory, you know, had to work through that. And when they hear it from, you know, you and us, then it's more powerful and they go, oh, wow. Okay. I can do this too. And, thanks for sharing that.
Well, and it's okay to be scared.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't know. It's okay. Cause we're all scared and we're all, some of the most encouraging things I've done for people is shared the fact that I was failing.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I never saw you like that. And I go, well, I have the exact same emotions you do. I just have a different life or a different job. And it really is powerful. You know, it's
well, I'm a cowgirl at heart. I live on a ranch. I spend my non-doctor time. I spend it really as a cowgirl. And, you know, the cowboy adage is, you know, courage is having courage and being courageous does not mean being not afraid. Means being scared as hell and going ahead anyway.
Yep.
And that's what courage is. So I would say, you know, I was scared. And I said, you know, I truly had moments where I thought, you know, this can't be happening. But courage is being scared and saying, no, I'm doing it anyway. You know, and the other cowboy adage that I've relied upon a lot, which is, you know, when you find yourself riding through hell, keep riding.
Keep writing.
Absolutely true.
Wow.
So well said. So thank you so much for sharing your story and, man, the importance of being, you know, we all need to be our own advocates and seek out all the options. Mm-hmm. I hate the word alternatives, but all the things for our health that's best for us. And just because someone is an expert in one field doesn't mean they know all about all things. And would you hit the nail on the head with how to do that and the importance of patients doing that for themselves. So we wish you a complete cancer-free journey here on out. I pray for your 5 days of fasting.
I start again on Sunday, the 18th. And I'm thinking, oh, it's coming too fast. You know, the 3 weeks in between seem to fly by.
So. Right. I'm thinking just like on Yellowstone, go out in the the teepee tent in the wilderness and just be by yourself for 5 days so you don't have to deal with people, and then it's all good, right? Anyway, exactly. Thanks for being here. Always a pleasure to have you on and share, and we will, we know we'll have a ton of listeners.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate you you highlighting this, and I think physician as patient is an important topic, so thanks for doing it.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much to Dr. Victory for joining us and sharing her profound journey and insights. Her experience with breast cancer amid the whole COVID shenanigans sheds light on the necessity of patient advocacy and doing your own research.
Yeah.
The critical examination of medical algorithms and the innovative use of repurposed drugs in treating complex diseases. The part I loved about this is her case is really a metaphor for how things should be done. You should be using allopathic medicine to its absolute limits. You should also be asking questions, and you should be doing whatever else is helpful, whether it's vitamin D, whether it's fasting, whether it's ketogenic diet. All of the above need to be done, and all of them need to be integrated into standard medical practice, because it isn't alternative medicine. It's just medicine that most doctors don't know about. And so I just thought that she painted such a perfect picture of how you can be aggressive. Also, her vulnerability on talking about what this felt like.
Yes, that's always my goal when we do these doctor's patient episodes, to pull that from people, because everybody experiences something different, and everybody deals with stress, trauma, and something like this differently. And just to know that, even though we're physicians and healthcare workers with our hand on the pulse of things, and sometimes the ability to be connected and want to control things, we can't, and we are vulnerable too. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah. And I think it's just
to Kelly for sharing that,
you know, ultimately it's a story that's very encouraging all the way through.
Yes.
So, excellent episode. I mean, this is one that I may go back and listen to myself again, just because I found it so, so important. And on to the shout out. So thank you, Jason Peter, for hanging out with us on Doc Tales. We really like it. You are very funny. I think you need to keep your Harley when you move, and then I can come up from the south and we can intersect, and maybe we can go hang out in Milwaukee or something.
Tim would love to go riding with you again. He misses you, but stay connected and keep joining us on the Doc Tales. We miss you, and thanks for being there for us and everybody else. Thanks for chiming in. We appreciate you being here. We always ask for your feedback in a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple. And you'll hear me saying this weekly now. And it almost feels like I'm not begging. It's just an ask.
I don't care if it's begging. Just do it.
Because we really, really do benefit from you giving us that rating. And so it's the one thing you can do to help us in return. For all this great content we bring in your way with these great guests. So rate us, review us, write a little comment, short, sweet, and it does help the algorithms and our podcast get found, more listens, and helps us grow and bring you better content with amazing guests. All right, everybody, we will see you all next time.
It's no secret that medicine is a bit uptight. That's why Tim and I created BS Free MD, to mix things up a little and have fun in the process. Besides, we are having these exact same discussions all the time, so we thought we might as well invite everyone to the party. If you really like us, you can get plenty more and maybe see one of Tim's cool tattoos on our Instagram or Facebook pages at BS Free MD. See you next time.
While we try to keep BS Free MD as raw and real as possible, we can't be held responsible for any medical decisions or discussions had as a result of what you've heard on the show. We know, bummer. But the truth is, we really do care about your questions. So feel free to reach out to us by email at doc@bsfreemd.com.